Okay, and it's on. Very good. So now we do and tonight is lesson number 6. And it's a very important one. This is taken out of Isaiah. We're starting now. I believe last lesson we finished the last of the Torah with Deuteronomy 18, a prophet like Moses. And this lesson is the first of the prophets. We're going to have quite a few of them. Quite a few of those lessons are going to be in Isaiah. Isaiah was a very prolific prophet when it came to tell us about the coming of the Messiah. This one is a very popular messianic prophecy, also very controversial. It's the prophecy when we find out that, well, maybe it's not true, we're going to find out today, but apparently Messiah was going to be born of a virgin. So as a lot of controversy, I can tell you right now, it is true. But just in case you don't watch beyond this, I don't want to, you know, send any false message. But there's a lot of controversy, and I'll share with you why. One of the first thing that I hear all the time is you know, Jewish people telling me, "Well, this is crazy. Born of a virgin, never heard of," and it's just like it's that doesn't make any sense. And my question would be like, well, do you believe in miracles? Well, yeah, maybe, but not that kind. I said, well, is a miracle, or is it partial miracle, or small miracle? Or, I mean, if it's a miracle, it's a miracle. If God can perform a miracle, there's no limit to what he can do. And so this should just fit in the list of miracles. And Jewish people often will say, well, I don't believe in miracles. Then it's time we just stop and say, well, let me start listing what happened in the wilderness when God took the children of Israel out of Egypt into the promised land. You start listing the parting of the sea, and then, you know, feeding them for 40 years, and their clothes didn't wear off, and on and on and on. And you can talk about other biblical miracles. Of course, I would stay as close as possible to the beginning of the Bible, the Torah, which is the most inspired in the mind of many Jewish people. It is, of course, as inspired as the rest of the Bible. But if you're going to be dealing with people that think it maybe is it's more inspired, I would stick to that part of the Bible, and it's got plenty of stories in there. So it's just a miracle. The problem with this prophecy of Isaiah 7, chapter 7, is that it appears that there's a couple of events happening, and Christian theologians have had difficulties looking at it and reconciling the fact that maybe there's more than one prophecy in there. They look at a double fulfillment. It happened then, and then it's going to happen again. So, you know, we're going to be looking at that and kind of you know, maybe clear up a couple of misconceptions. And we'll look at it from a Christian perspective and from a Jewish perspective. The passage that we need to read to give us the context of what's happening is in Isaiah 7, chapter it's really chapter 13 through 17, but I'm going to read you 1 through 17, the whole chapter. It's not that long, and it will give us a good context. And I always recommend we do that when we look at a passage, especially a difficult one or controversial one. We need to put the whole thing in context. So Isaiah 7, 1 through 17, and it's on page 1 and the top of page 2. Now it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. When it was reported to the house of David, saying, "The Arameans have camped in Ephraim," his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear-Yashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, 'Take care and be calm, have no fear and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands, on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah, because Aram with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has planned evil against you, saying, "Let us go up against Judah and terrorize it and make for ourselves a breach in its walls and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it." Thus says the Lord God, "I shall not stand nor shall it come to pass." It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Now within another 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered, so that it is no longer a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe, you surely shall not last. Then the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Make it deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Then he said, listen now, O house of David. Is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men that you will try the patience of my God as well? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. The Lord will bring on you, on your people, and on your father's house such days as have never come since the day that Ephraim separated from Judah, the king of Assyria. So we've got a virgin birth, or a virgin conception, we should say. And then there's this boy that, you know, the child will bear a son, and the virgin will be with child, bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. And they're talking about he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. Well, is this the same boy? Is this a different boy? What do we make of all this? Well, let's look at it. In the context of the book of Isaiah, chapter 7 through 12, make a unit referred to as the book of Emmanuel. The name Emmanuel is found there three times in that unit, in chapter 7:14, as we just saw, in 8:8, and in 8:10. Also to be noted is the fact that that children in the Bible, and you probably already knew that, names, I would not even say just not children, but names in general in the Bible, were always given, children in the Bible were always given names that would reflect their character based on the thinking of the parents. The name had a meaning. Okay, and you didn't just call a person any name just because it sounded good, or because it was, you know, somebody liked that name, or it rhymed with the, you know, whatever. There was a meaning behind it, and so just keep that in mind. Emmanuel literally means with us, God. So this coming one described in Isaiah 7 will be God among us, God coming with us, or, you know, literally, basically known as God among us. Of all the messianic prophecies, Isaiah 7:14 is probably the most controversial, as it is disputed between rabbis and evangelical theologians alike. As the passage talks about a sign that seems to be describing a short-term prophecy, but that is always applied to the birth of the Messiah. So it's a little confusing there. Also, the use of the word Alma to depict the virgin has caused much discussion, and some say that it is a virgin, some say the word describes a young and married woman, some even say that Alma does not necessarily describe a virgin. So we'll look at that too. A close look at the passage will let us understand the meaning of the prophecy. At first glance, it appears contradictory, but in reality, there are two different prophecies given by Isaiah in the same passage. One short-term, and one long-term. Additionally, a study of all other occurrences of the word Alma in the Tanakh will elucidate and validate its meaning beyond the shadow of a doubt. So we'll look at the two different prophecies. That's the one thing that a lot of people don't pay attention to. They think that it's a prophecy. How can it be a prophecy about the birth of the Messiah, which would come 700 years several hundred years after that prophecy, yet it talks about the young boy that's going to be that should be coming in their lifetime. So it's kind of confusing. Well, we'll see that it's really two prophecies. A little reminder about hermeneutics. We talked about it at the beginning of the class. Hermeneutics is a science of interpretation and explanation of any written text, biblical or other. In an effort to make sense of Isaiah 7:13-14, which requires an immediate sign to King Ahaz, many evangelicals have claimed that the prophecy was a good example of double fulfillment, where the prophecy might have more than one fulfillment at different times of history. I'm not comfortable with that, because then you really don't know, and this is nothing new. first class we did. I talked to you, and I talked to you about double fulfillment is not necessarily a biblical approach. I'd rather talk about double reference, which is what's being used here. Double reference simply claims that one block of scripture dealing with one person, event, and time may be followed by another block of scripture dealing with a different person, event, and time without indicating in the text itself if there is a gap of time. It's the idea of looking at two mountain peaks. If you look at it this way, you see there's a valley between the two. But if you look at them this way, or I should go two peaks like this. If you look at it this way, you see one peak and a valley in the middle and another peak. Prophecy number one, prophecy number two. Yet, sometimes if you look at it this way, all you see is one peak and you don't know there is a gap of time between the two, and it could be happening at the same time or with the same people. So we need to be able to separate those two. Sometimes you find it in the text. Sometimes you've got to go further within the context of the Bible to clarify the meaning. But here, we'll see it's explainable within the text. First, what I want to do is look at the word alma. And I'm going to erase this. It has nothing to do with our class for tonight, just in case I need the board. The word alma, much has been written about on the meaning of the Hebrew word alma. In this passage, it is translated as virgin. Okay? So is it really virgin, or does it mean, you know, a young woman, or a young woman who hasn't been married, a young woman who hasn't had sexual relation? What does it really mean? The Hebrew language has three words for virgin, okay? It's amazing how sometimes, how detailed Hebrew can be in a language that you think is so obscure and so ancient. It can be very detailed. The first word, not necessarily in any order, okay? The first one I listed is na'ara, and it means damsel. It can refer to either a virgin, like in 1 Kings 1:2, or a non-virgin, like in Ruth 2:6. And I put them both there, and of course the bold is my addition. 1 Kings 1:2. So his servant said to him, "Let them seek a young virgin for my lord the king, and let her attend the king and become his nurse, and let her lie in your bosom, that my lord the king may keep warm." So here it means a virgin, the word na'ara. And then in Ruth, "And the servant in charge of the reapers answered and said, 'She's a young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moabite.'" In that context, she was a widow. So she was not a virgin. It meant a young woman. So na'ara cannot be only used for virgin. The next word is betula. This word is usually considered to mean a virgin exclusively. Scholars have argued that if Isaiah wanted to say virgin for sure, he would have used the word betula. However, a further word study shows that the word does not mean virgin only. For instance, in Joel 1:8, it refers to a widow again. "Wail like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth." Not a virgin, a widow. It describes her as a virgin, but it doesn't mean a virgin in the sense of a woman who never had relations with a man. Genesis 24:16, the writer had to add a phrase, "had never known a man." If it meant a virgin, you didn't have to add "had never known a man." You don't need to add that descriptive here. To clarify the meaning of betula, as it refers to Rebekah, soon to become Isaac's wife. Genesis 24:16, "And the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had had relation with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up." So right there, it's clear that betula cannot mean a virgin, because it had to be clarified what was meant. Judges 21:12, the writer had to add the phrase "had never known a man" to clarify the meaning of betula again. Judges 21:12, "And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with them." That's pretty clear here. "And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan." The word, Hebrew word for virgin in the text here is betula, but again, it is not enough in and of itself. It has to have a qualifier, you know, who had not known a man by lying with him. So it's clear from this passage that betula cannot dogmatically be used to describe a virgin. It leaves us with the last word, alma. This word means either a virgin, a young virgin, or a virgin of marriageable age. The word is used 7 times in the Tanakh, and never it is used to describe a married woman. Let us review all 7 instances of the word alma. Genesis 24:43. In contrast to 24:16, 24:43 does not require additional qualifying words to describe a virgin. It is used of Rebekah, who was a virgin at the time of her marriage to Isaac, and describes her as a maiden or virgin. Genesis 24:43, and I read, "Behold, I am standing by the spring, and may it be that the maiden who comes out to draw, and to whom I say, 'Please let me drink a little water from your jar.'" So here the word maiden/virgin is the word alma. Exodus 2:8 is a reference to Moses' sister. Yeah, Moses' sister Miriam, who was a virgin. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Psalm 68:25 is used in reference to the royal procession of virgins. The king is a reference to God himself, and it is highly unlikely that God will allow unchaste, unmarried woman in his procession. Promiscuous women that would not be married, so that wouldn't work that way. The singers went on, and musicians after them, in the midst of the maidens beating tambourines. So this is another reference to virgins. Song of Solomon, a couple of them, 1:3, in the context of purity and marriage, and you can see note later on page 6 and 7 of Rashi's commentary that I put on the notes there. Song of Solomon 1:3, "Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil. Therefore, the maidens love you." In 6:8 of Song of Solomon, the word is used in contrast to wives and concubines who obviously are not virgins. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. So that's Solomon 6:8. Proverbs 30:18-19. Here the word is used in contrast to an adulteress. "There are 3 things which are too wonderful for me, 4 which I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid," or a virgin. And Isaiah 7:14. Why assume that Isaiah 7:14 is not the word virgin, where it is virgin every single time everywhere else? Why would God change the meaning all of a sudden? Or, you know, it just doesn't make sense. Isaiah 7:14, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel." So another another thing that is, to me, really the first time I heard that, it kind of helped me solidify the idea that this was really the right word. Because the argument did not even exist when the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament, was made 200 BC, 200 before Yeshua came. The argument was not an argument. Nobody of all the rabbis who translated the Old Testament into Greek, nobody said, "Wait a minute, is this really virgin? Or maybe does it mean like a young woman? Or don't you think it's a little crazy?" Back then, they had nothing to look at but what had transpired up to that point. They had the Jewish Bible, and they certainly did not know anything in details about who Yeshua was and what he was going to do. He had not come on the scene yet. It would be another 200 years before he would come. So there was no agenda. That's the thing. There was no agenda to try to change the meaning of things and make it sound like it's not what it is. They look at the word alma, and then immediately, I was not there, and it was after all 70 rabbis, so nothing happened immediately when you put 70 rabbis in the same room. But unanimously, I should say, maybe not immediately, but unanimously, they said alma. Easy. Let's use the word Parthenos. And Parthenos in Greek means virgin. There's only one way to describe virgin in Greek. It's Parthenos. So there you have it. And These writers, of course, lived much closer to the days of Isaiah, as well as 200 years before the birth of Messiah. The Messiahship of Yeshua was not an issue within the Jewish community at that time. So it seems to be pretty clear that Alma means virgin. Now, of course, I don't have to do much work to convince you, because you believe me and you believe the Bible and you think it makes a lot of sense. Rashi, in his commentary, says all kinds of interesting things, but turn the page on page 7 here, and he says, he doesn't give us a whole lot of indication of anything, except at the end he even says, the last sentence of his commentary on "She shall call his name Emmanuel," he said, "And some interpret that this is the sign that she was a young girl and incapable of giving birth." In other words, a virgin. Not being able to give. I mean, she was young and she had not had relations. That's what it means here. So even Rashi, who does not like to admit it, says that there's something that, I mean, for him to, he doesn't do this very often. He doesn't say he agrees with it, but he cannot ignore the fact that many before him came up with the idea that, you know, maybe this is describing a virgin who's going to give birth to a child, which is unheard of. Okay? So,
this is good. I mean, I've studied that passage a lot of times, but I haven't seen all this.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad it's helpful. So the last sentence of Rashi's commentary leaves the door open for the possibility of Alma meaning virgin. Of course, when we say leaving the door open for the possibility of Alma meaning virgin, this is really what I would tell a Jewish person who does not believe that Alma means virgin, because I'm convinced it's what it says. But with Rashi saying, like, well, some people believe that, for him to admit that and put it in his commentary, it had to carry quite some weight, because I've seen in other places in his commentaries on the Tanakh where he would completely ignore the issue or change it completely. So, additionally, Rashi does translate Alma as virgin in his commentary on Song of Solomon 1:3. Maidens, virgins, since the text compares him to a youth whose beloved holds him dear, and according to the allegory, the maidens are the nation. So he's saying here, in another context, another place, there's the word Alma, and there he translates it virgin. So he says, yeah, it's virgin anywhere, but right there, not my favorite translation, because, again, Rashi lives in, at the time of the First Crusades, the Jewish people are being persecuted by the church, and Rashi feels like it is part of his calling to the Jewish community to protect the Jewish community. So as a result, he is going to. I didn't live in his time, so I don't know how much of it he did knowingly, and how much of it he did just out of. Just loving his people and trying to help him, or if there was really malice in what he did, you know, we can't judge that. But the result is that a lot of the messianic prophecies interpretation were changed at the time of Rashi and never changed back. And people just accepted it and said, yeah, this doesn't mean that, this doesn't mean the Jews, but it means Israel, and on and on and on. So we'll see a lot of that with Isaiah 53. If we ever get there, but that's quite interesting to see how things were changed, mostly to protect the Jewish people from being completely eradicated, and from preserving the Jewish people keeping the Jewish people from quote unquote converting to Christianity. Of course, it's important to remind ourselves that Jewish people do not convert to Christianity. Jewish people find the Jewish Messiah. Gentiles convert to Christianity, or whatever you want to call it, but, you know, to the, you know, following Yeshua. Jews find their Messiah and become completed, or whatever you want to call it. But I never like to say it to a Jewish person, or to myself as a Jew, yeah, I converted 30 years ago. I didn't convert to anything. I just found my Messiah. Another gentleman that needs to be mentioned is Gerald Siegel. Gerald Siegel is the resident scholar, and honestly, scholar is used very loosely here, because there's very little that I agree with him. And frankly, what he's doing, and I don't know any of his other works, but this body of work that he's done that has been used by Jews for Judaism, which is the anti-missionary organization, there was one book, it might have been updated by now, I don't know, but there's one book with all the, you know, the rebuttals to the messianic prophecies, and Gerald Siegel basically bases a lot of his argument on the teachings of Rashi. And it all goes back to Rashi. Before Rashi, this was not an issue. Before Rashi, the rabbi agreed that this prophecy would talk about the Messiah, that prophecy would talk about the Messiah. What they didn't know is which Messiah and when. But they said, yeah, there's no way that, you know, this is a messianic prophecy. Like, you know, Genesis 49:10, the one to whom it belongs, Shiloh, all those things. It's like, it's messianic in nature. They just did not agree necessarily on who the person, who it was describing, if any of them even knew. But now from Rashi on, and including Gerald Siegel, who is a contemporary of ours, it's all changed. But here he gives us a very vague explanation, and it's very vague. It says absolutely nothing. It doesn't solve the problem, and it's not even confusing. It's just it's devoid of any meaning. The question, if Alma means young woman in Hebrew, why did the Jewish scholar who translated the book of Isaiah into Greek use a Greek word for virgin, Parthenos? That's the question he's asking. Answer. And that's his big statement there, which he actually does not back up whatsoever. And it's like, well, you got to believe me. Just believe me when I say that. And just don't check it, okay? Just believe me, because I'm a good guy and I know my stuff. So that's not what he says, but that's what he implies. The Septuagint is not necessarily a literal translation. Said who? Said Gerald Siegel. Based on what? I don't know. You can't tell. Therefore, so he's already making a conclusion here. Because I said it's not literal, then it's allegorical and it could be anything it wants. So therefore, you know, based on that, you can just go on and basically destroy the argument. But it is not true that the Septuagint is not necessarily a literal translation. But based on that false premise, then he builds the rest of his argument, which is very weak. Therefore, the use of Parthenos by the Septuagint translator of the book of Isaiah may have best represented his interpretive understanding of the physical state of the young woman of Isaiah 7:14 at the time of the annunciation of the sign. Thus, its use does not naturally lead to the conclusion that he was also speaking of virginal conception. In fact, the presence of Parthenos as the rendering of Alma did not give rise in any Jewish community of the pre-Christian era to a belief in the virginal conception of Emmanuel. That's not true. That's exactly what they did. By translating Parthenos means that it was a virgin. So it's a very weak argument, and it's on top of that based on something that he's not proving at all. He's saying the Septuagint is not necessarily a literal translation. Doesn't give us any other examples. Doesn't give it any, you know, so it's very, very weak. So let's look at the prophecy itself, not that we've described a couple of the words. To understand the context better, we need to look at the historical background for this passage, starting at the beginning of Isaiah 7, chapter 7. The threat to the house of David. That's the first two verses of Isaiah 7. The Assyrian Empire is on the rise at this time of history, which is threatening to the smaller kingdoms of the Middle East, such as Aram, which is Syria, and the northern kingdom of Israel, as well as the southern kingdom of Judah. Syria and Israel have decided to join forces against their common enemy. They still are not strong enough, though, so they invite Judah to join. King Ahaz of Judah refuses to join. Israel and Judah decide to conspire against There's a mistake here. Israel and Syria, not Judah. You see that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just want to make sure you're paying attention. Israel and Syria decide to conspire against Judah to dethrone Ahaz and also depose the entire house of David. See, it tells you that no matter how many times I reread my notes, I don't reread them enough. Their purpose is to establish a new dynasty more in favor of the alliance against the Assyrians. This is a direct attack against the Davidic dynasty eternally established by God, and it is doomed to failure. I mean, the Davidic dynasty through which Yeshua will come is not going to be stopped. It's not going to happen, okay? Because God said it wouldn't. So, but of course, Ahaz was such a spiritual giant. And we see that later when he's given a chance to ask God a sign. And he said, oh, no, I would never do that to God. So Ahaz was scared. Again, Ahaz, just like we looked at Balaam a couple of weeks ago, Balaam is really not a role model for Christians. Ahaz is not a role model for Christians. But from the context, from the angle of human nature, as spiritual as we might be today or yesterday or tomorrow or whatever, we do go through moments in our lives or moments in our day when we doubt. And we know intellectually that God is behind everything, that God is in control of everything. I can think of what happened yesterday. We go like, okay, what's going on? What's going to happen now? But we know that God is in control. Yet, human nature is such that, I was almost in tears this morning when I got up. I'm just like, what are we going to do now? And I had to stop and take a deep breath and go like, I'm not going to do anything. You're in charge. And so now it's not a matter of what are we going to do as a result of what cannot be changed. Is how can we do to be the best witness that we can be in a situation that we can no longer control? We could never control anyway in the first place. But anyway, that's my little side note on the events of yesterday. And today is November 7th, 2012. Just in case people want to know what I'm talking about, we'll let them figure out the rest. Okay. So I look at King Ahaz and I realize that as unspiritual as he might be and not interested in God of Israel, there's a human aspect about him that we can all relate to, that we do make those doubtful, we have those doubtful moments when we go like, what am I going to do? Should I take care of my own destiny? Should I make some decisions that do not include God just because I can probably take care of it myself, and it's ever doomed for failure. But the destruction of the Davidic dynasty, eternally promised by God, is not an issue. It's never going to happen. So Ahaz didn't know that, so he went on with his plans. The message to Ahaz, Isaiah 7, 3 through 9, King Ahaz is an idol worshiper and is terrified of the possible outcome of a conflict with the other two kingdoms. In verse 3, Isaiah is sent by God to meet with Ahaz, and Isaiah takes his son, Shear Yashub, with him. And his son is just a couple years old, not even that. He's a young, obviously he's very young. In verse 4, 6, before somebody asks me what Shear Yashub means, let me tell you, I just don't remember at the moment. I mean, I wrote it down, and it's not in my notes, and it's bugging me because it was a cool name. So I'll have to let you know next time. Or you can look it up too, but I'm drawing a blank. In verse 4 through 6, Isaiah tells Ahaz not to worry about being overthrown, as it won't happen. Isaiah plays with the Hebrew name of the person supposed to overthrow Ahaz, and by changing one vowel, we don't see it in the English text, in the Hebrew, he changes them from God is good to good for nothing. It's just like, the Hebrew prophets do have a sense of humor. Again, because of God's promise in the Davidic covenant, the plot to dethrone Ahaz cannot succeed. So there comes a sign, Isaiah 7, 10, and 11, the offer of a sign in Isaiah 7, 10, and 11. Ahaz has a greater faith in the Assyrian Empire than in the God of Israel, obviously. God speaks a second time, this time offering a sign as deep as Sheol and as high as the heavens. This is equivalent to God saying to Ahaz, pick a sign, any sign, the sky's the limit. Pick one, whatever you want. Ahaz has a chance to ask a sign of God to be convinced that he can trust him about the doomed failure of the Assyrians. So what is he going to do? Verse 12. All of a sudden, Ahaz becomes very spiritual and tells God he does not want to tempt him. This is a misapplied reference to Deuteronomy 6:16, which I've listed right at the end of that paragraph. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah. Here, God offered to give a sign to Ahaz, but Ahaz does not want a sign because he does not want to put an end to his alliance with Assyria. He still thinks that he's going to be able to do better on his own with his human friends and with his alliance than he would do with trusting the God of Israel. Now we've got the sign, so that's one sign. Then there's a sign to the house of David. All of a sudden, Isaiah now stops addressing Ahaz, and in particular, in terms of the entire house of David, the Jewish people. The English language does not do justice to the singular and plural usage of the word you. See, we have it in French. When I say, when I talk to Trudy, I will say, est-ce que tu as faim? Are you hungry? Tu means you, singular. And if I talk to all of you, I will say, est-ce que vous avez faim? You, plural. So you knew right away, of course in French, on top of that, you ask the plural of you know, the polite version of, you can say vous to a person if you don't know them well. But technically, tu is for singular, vous is for plural. Same in Hebrew. Same in Hebrew. You don't see it in English. But what's happening is that all of a sudden, the verse, it's like use, like plural, use, and then you. So when you look in the Hebrew, you go like, wait a minute, he's not talking to the same person here. All of a sudden, he's talking to a person, and he's talking to a group of person, and then he's coming back to a person. But you have to look at it in Hebrew, in English, with you, it loses all its subtle, you know, the differences. So the word you, the English language does not do justice to the singular and plural usage of the word you throughout the passage. It is in a singular in verses 9, 11, 16, and 17, but plural in verse 13 and 14. So you got 9, 11, singular, 13, 14, plural, 16, 17, singular. So it's like singular, plural, singular. Additionally, the word behold in the Hebrew is a word that is drawing attention to an event, and in this grammatical context, it is speaking of a future event, a future birth, and a future conception. The text here in the Hebrew says ha-alma, the word alma, again, remember, is virgin, the virgin and not a virgin. In looking for a reference in the immediate context, we don't find any. So we must look, remember, you look at the verse, then the passage, then maybe another book. You know, it's intextual, intratextual, and intertextual and intertextual. You know, closer, a little further, and then the whole Bible. So here we don't find any reference to a virgin in any previous verse or in that passage in Isaiah, or even anywhere in Isaiah. So we must look at possible previous reference, and of course we're taken all the way back to Genesis 3:15 in the prophecy of the seed of the woman, which, remember, is a, I told you at the beginning, the very first one we did was a hint at the virgin birth. Not until you get to Isaiah 7:14 can you go back and say, aha, I can put the two together. At Genesis 3:15, all you have is a very, very thin line of evidence about virgin birth, because there's only a woman and there's no father. And you're like, well, how can you be born of a woman with no father? So at this point, it's like nobody's asking the question. It's very vague. But now we're getting more details here. Messiah is to be reckoned after the seed of the woman because he would have no human father. His conception would be a virgin one. Here God is promising that the house of David will not be deposed or lose its identity until the birth of a virgin-born son. This requires that Messiah be born before the destruction of the temple, again because of the identity issue. So now let's look at the other sign, because there's a sign to the house of David that's a long-term sign, and then, but the house of David is not really present. The Jewish people are not really present when he's giving the sign. He's giving the sign to be recorded in Scripture. But right there, the Ahaz, he's got to give him a sign, because remember, prophets were to prove that they were prophets. You look back in Deuteronomy, and if a prophet says something and it's not, you can't prove it, or it's not 100% right on, what happened to him? Stone him. Stoner, I wish they would do that with some of those televangelists nowadays. Don't get me started. No, I mean, I don't, I just, that didn't sound right. It's just like, you know, anyway, why did I say that? Why did I say that? I didn't say it. Yeah, it's on tape and on video, but I didn't see it. Okay, so Now that we know that 7:14 is a long-term prophecy to happen 700 years down the road, we must address the short-term prophecy, or short-term sign to Ahaz. The you in verse 16 is again in the singular, meaning Ahaz. So now Isaiah is talking to Ahaz again. Before Isaiah's son is old enough to know right from wrong, the kings of Israel will no longer be a threat to Ahaz, which happened in history. This was fulfilled within 3 years. Isaiah uses the definite article before boy, the boy. Again, making the boy, making it the boy, but this time there is an earlier reference in 7:1 or 7:2. We read about, what was the, let's see, 7:3. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear Yashuv. So it was, you know, take your son to work day for Isaiah. You know, it's like, I'm going to take my son to the office today. So he took his little boy. And here it says, the boy, the son will, you know, the Isaiah's son is old enough to know right from wrong. And it's talking about the boy, referring to an earlier reference to whatever boy it was. And again, in the same chapter this time, right away, just a few verses prior to that that verse in 15 through 17, we read about Shear Yashuv, Isaiah's son. This is why Isaiah was commanded to bring him along. Isaiah was probably also not knowing why. Why all of a sudden, you know, because the job of a prophet was not exactly, you know, safe. I mean, how did Isaiah die? He was put in a hollow log and cut in half. You know, it's a good thing that happened the day he brought his son to work. That would have been, you know, terrible. But he brought his son, and the only reason why he brought his son, it was because he was, you know, in the prophecies. You know, he gives a sign that will take place in the future for Jewish people, for the line of, through the line of David, the birth of the Messiah, was using the word Alma, which is amazing when you think about it. And then he's telling Ahaz, by the way, let me tell you something, before my son is old enough to know right from wrong, that's pretty young, because you know, kids very quickly learn to say no and learn to do things, you know, for me. So, and within 3 years, this was fulfilled, where the people group that were a threat to Ahaz were no longer a threat. So, conclusion of this big mess here. The two signs found in this prophecy are the promise to the house of David to be preserved until the birth of a virgin-born son, Messiah himself. That long-term prophecy, or promise, served as an encouragement to the house of David, who would go through 700 years before its fulfillment. The promise to Ahaz, personally, that the threatening kings of Israel will no longer be a problem within a very short time. Shear Yashuv was still nursing when his dad brought him with him. Within 2 years, 2 or 3 years, the short-term prophecy was fulfilled, which also served to validate Isaiah's prophetic office. We can deduce from that prophecy Messiah will be born of a virgin, and that's the further development of Genesis 3:15, and that Messiah will be born before the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. That's pretty much it for Isaiah 7:14. And I think it's a great prophecy, and it's a really cool prophecy, and just it's one of my favorite. So if you have any questions, I'm going to...
Did you turn that off?
It's off, but I'm going to...